My name is Sarah Dugan. I'm an associate professor at the Northeast Ohio Medical University, and I am a mental health pharmacist. I work with the Department of Pharmacy Practice and the Department of Psychiatry.
How did you get into that particular niche?
I did a rotation as a pharmacy student at a community mental health clinic, and I was exposed to the first time to patients with severe mental illness. And I came to the realization that while we can help patients control their blood pressure and their blood sugar levels and maybe give them extra years of life, they may never have felt sick and may never feel any different, even though we're making them better, we're getting them to goal. Patients with mental illness are different. When they're suffering and they have symptoms, it's obvious to everyone, and they become stigmatized. But when you make them better, they can have a life. They can have their own apartment. They can manage their own money. They can have a relationship. They can pursue a career. So it's a really different set of goals.
So making them better means what?
Making them better in a lot of cases may be reducing their symptoms so they can be functional, so they can have a conversation, so they can have consistent relationships, so they can pursue other activities that they want to do, be them social or pursue a job, finish their education, whatever they want to do with their life, as opposed to being potentially hindered by symptoms that could really interfere with their ability to do that.
Talk about the tools.
There are a lot of different approaches that we can use for mental illness. Medications are a big one. They're one that I think a lot of people focus on primarily, but they are not the only one. There are a lot of other avenues of treatment, including therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, cognitive enhancement therapy. There's a lot of mindfulness and other types of activities that patients could be enrolled in to really help them become functional and become well.
Talk about some of those. Mindfulness jumps out at me. The last I heard, Tim Ryan was talking about doing that on Capitol Hill. So talk about that one.
So mindfulness is really helping draw attention to what's going on. So really paying attention without judgment to the symptoms that they may be experiencing, maybe what their symptoms may be causing them trouble with, and it gives them an opportunity to think about how might I be able to go about this differently? How might I be able to, if it's an anxiety-related condition, are there things that I could do that will help me better manage my anxiety so I can give the presentation, so that I can get out in public or with other people? So it can be used in a bunch of different ways, and there are tremendous variability in access that patients can have. There are free apps that treat mindfulness, and then there are individuals who are trained to really help them either individually or in group therapy.
Talk a little more about individual and group therapy. Where does that fit for a lot of folks? And again, I realize there's wide variation.
Yes, there is a tremendous amount of variation. So individual therapy could be very beneficial for some patients, patients who may not necessarily do well with other individuals. I think we often think of individual therapy for depression and anxiety management, maybe for patients with post-traumatic stress disorder, so they can individually work on some of their things, be it identifying their symptoms or finding other ways to be able to cope with them. On the depression side, maybe it's recognizing some of the negative thoughts and being able to challenge some of them, so that they're able to recognize that they have the negative thinking and they're able to challenge that a little bit and look at other options so things don't look quite as bleak as maybe they did originally. Group therapy could also be incredibly helpful. It could be helpful for medication management, so talking about side effects and the role of medications or other activities that they should be involved with. I think group therapy, a lot of individuals will think of substance use disorder, and individuals who go to Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous, and they use it as a support group. So it's a social setting as well as being somewhat therapeutic. So the groups can really function in a number of different ways.
And then medication, where does that fit in this whole range?
Medication plays a big role in mental health. A lot of individuals will turn to medications primarily as one of the first line treatments. And in some cases, that's appropriate. In other cases, that may not be the best option. So for patients who may have mild to moderate anxiety or depression, medications could be an option, but those non-medication things like the therapy may be much more appropriate. For other illnesses such as bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, medications really are one of the main components that we use in treatment to try to help get symptoms under control so a patient might be able to focus on therapy and participate in therapy.
A couple of the women that I've spoken to, it was their GP. It was not a trip to a psychiatrist. Their GP prescribed. What is that relationship? How does that work?
I think that's great news that their general practitioners were prescribing. Their mental health is a major problem, and there often are places where it's difficult to be able to get into a specialist, or things like depression and anxiety are prevalent enough that our primary care folks really are the ones who are providing a lot of that care, except for patients who become much more difficult to treat or haven't responded to some of the traditional therapies, so we need to look at some other options. So the more we can empower the primary care providers to provide that care and be comfortable with that, the better off the patients are going to be, because that'll open up access tremendously. The other component to that relationship is some of the medicines that we use to treat mental illness, specifically bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. Those medicines can create side effects that then can cause other medical conditions. So it's essential that both the mental health providers as well as the primary care providers are really on the same page. If we have a medication like olanzapine or Zyprexa that we're using for schizophrenia, that may make a patient not paranoid. It may clear their thoughts up, but they've now gained weight. Their sugar levels are high. Their cholesterol levels are high. So they're going to need a primary care doctor to help manage some of those other things, because in some cases, it may not be appropriate to take them off of that medication.
So what kind of training do you do of primary care physicians, or does anybody do?
So primary care physicians will get, all physicians will get general information on each of the drug classes. There's been a big push recently to try to encourage the primary care physicians to be much more comfortable with using and managing some of the more complicated mental health medications like the antipsychotics. Here at NeoMed, we bring our students, our medicine students, our pharmacy students. We've also had nursing and social work students from other institutions for an interdisciplinary case conference to tackle just this issue. You have a complicated patient that has a mental health condition, and she's been put on a medicine, clozapine, because she's failed other treatments. It's working very well for her, but now she has those medical conditions that are becoming much more problematic. So how do you navigate that relationship? So we're starting at the student level. We've also done education for some of the residents, and there's a lot of interest and effort to be able to educate and coordinate care with both the mental health providers and the primary care providers that are out in practice.
You mentioned the patient. Is there training that should be happening with regular folks on how to navigate and advocate for themselves when they're facing obviously some pretty big hurdles?
Absolutely. There is a very strong philosophy of patient-centered care. The patient absolutely has to be part of the discussion. So for a number of our medicines, both for depression and things like schizophrenia, there is not a clear, you use this medication first. It's a range of medications that are all effective, but it's finding the right fit for the patient. And it's based on how often you may need to take the medication. Do you need to take it with food or not? And what do those side effects look like? So each patient has their own threshold. So if they really value being awake and alert, they may not be a good candidate for some of the medications that cause sedation and make them tired and sleepy. So having the patient involved in those discussions, because if we find a great medicine that works, but they're going to be unwilling to take it because of the side effects they get, then we're still at square one. We still need to find a better medicine.
And yet, I'm thinking, I want to be sure I attribute this to the right person. I think it was the head of NAMI Ohio, who said part of the problem is it's a mean disease that chases away a lot of the support network a person would have.
Yes.
And they're not in the best position themselves to be asking their doctors questions and pressing, they're advocating for their own care. So what happens?
So in some cases, patients won't have a lot of support. They won't have a lot of individuals who are able to advocate consistently in their best interest, and that's a shame. There are a number of individuals who are part of the healthcare system, and they, while everyone's trying to look out for their best interest, sometimes the person gets lost. So the things that are important to them that they value that that really should be reflected as high priority in their care just are missed. They're not covered in those appointments that may only be 15 minutes. So that can be really challenging. Some of the systems have really started developing, some of the first episode programs have developed programs that educate the family and the support network to try to keep them involved in care, to keep them supporting the patient, to really explain what it is that's going on. And the hope is that then those relationships will be maintained and they won't be severed as the patient does go through and has to deal with this chronic disease long term. There are other places that are using patients who have the mental illness and are doing much better, and they call them peer support workers. So they're patients who have lived experience with the mental illness who are able to then provide assistance to the other patients who are still in treatment. So they're trying to come at it from a couple different angles.
You mentioned first episode. What's that?
So first episode would be patients who are having their first experience of psychosis. So they're patients who'd be diagnosed with schizophrenia who have hallucinations where they may hear things other people don't hear, see things other people don't see. They may be paranoid. Their thoughts may be confused. So they may really pull away from a lot of other activities they had been involved with and become isolated. So these patients are early in the course of disease, and there's a lot of evidence coming out that really supports the fact that if we can get their symptoms back under control, provide them with that support network of their family, and get them involved in training and socialization, they can do much better. They are able to keep their symptoms at bay. They are less likely to be hospitalized. They're more likely to finish their education and go on to employment. So it may change the trajectory of what their disease looks like long term.
Is part of that also where the medications, if they're on medications, would not need to be as strong as long as?
Absolutely. So part of the goal of first episode treatment is to give these patients antipsychotic medications that will treat their symptoms, but use the lowest possible dose that we can. So not trying to overestimate, but really just giving them the amount that they need. There's been evidence recently that's come out that says that dose reduction, like lowering the dose of these medicines in some patients, may actually help them reach functional recovery. So where they're able to be engaged in those activities that they want to be engaged in their everyday life. So it's going to be, it's best recognized in first episode programs to reduce the dose and use low doses, but it's really being challenged for other patients who really have a longer history of the disease as well.
You mentioned the 15-minute visit, and that's one of the things that I've run into, that insurance, if there is insurance, rewards the quick visit in and out, as opposed to talk therapy and some of the far more in-depth things you're talking about. How do you hit that balance?
That's a tough question. So there are a lot of cost constraints in all of healthcare in general. In the mental health system, it is not overrun with money, so it is important that they're seeing as many patients as they can, and those are nurse practitioners, physician assistants, as well as the physicians themselves, but using support individuals to gain more contact, more touches with the patients can help provide additional information, so those 15 minutes can be used optimally, so that you're not getting general information. Maybe that was gotten by somebody else, but you can really focus on some of those other factors. The more options that we have, if counseling or therapy would be the best option for these patients, it's important that we don't have those restrictions on the insurance, because, okay, you don't have to pay for the therapy sessions, but that may mean that the patient continues to be symptomatic and may then require a hospitalization or much more intensive therapy and treatment that may end up being more expensive to get them back on track.
When I came out here in 78, I worked for the Stark County Mental Health Board for a while, and that was the first, well, second wave, actually, of deinstitutionalization. It wasn't the final one, but there was talk about building this network of support in the community, housing, transportation, a whole range of services for people who up till then had been hospitalized. How has that evolved?
That's evolved in a number of different ways. There are some counties that have taken that and have been able to establish a very diverse network where they may have resources and supports for multiple levels of care for individuals that really need intensive care or individuals who don't need a whole lot of support, just need somebody checking in and providing some assistance here and there. But that's inconsistent between the counties. So there may be some counties that have been able to obtain levy dollars where they're able to really support a lot of robust services and things that are seen of as being extras, perks, like the peer support workers, where other counties may not have been able to get that support. So they may have much more limited resources or caseloads that are much larger just to be able to accommodate the most number of people that they can with the resources that they have. So it has evolved. I think that we're becoming much more targeted in where our treatments go, but it is inconsistent based on where people are.
So what can somebody in your position do to try to even that out?
I would like to think that we are empowering both pharmacy and medicine students to be able to go out there and make a difference. Patients with mental illness are everywhere. They'll be in absolutely every discipline. They get cancer, they have heart attacks, they have diabetes, they break bones. They're seen in all aspects of care. So my hope is that our graduates are going out there and are comfortable caring for these patients so that they would be able to identify if they are having trouble and try to activate them or reach out and network with their other providers so they can say, hey, I just saw this person. I think they're having a little bit of trouble. They may need to come in and see you. Or I have some concern. They were really sedated when they came into my appointment. We may need to make some medication adjustments, or maybe it would be helpful if they go be seen. For my pharmacy students, I want them out there talking with these patients. Adherence to medicine tends to be a big issue. For some patients, they may not believe that they have an illness, and the medicines that they're taking may give them side effects. So I'm taking a medicine that makes me not feel so good, and I'm not really sure what it's helping me with. That's a tough sell to keep them taking a medicine that will eventually keep them out of the hospital. So I think our community pharmacists are in a fantastic position to be able to provide education and support and check in on some of those patients who may not be regularly taking their medicine and maybe intervene before the patients would need to be hospitalized.
Of course, then we get back into that situation of what insurance pays for and rewards, and a lot of times it's mail order.
That's true. So in some cases, these medicines can be really expensive. So it may be a delicate balance. If they are required to go mail order, I think that there is an opportunity still to provide education, to have resources both for the patient and their families. But that would also be important information to report back to their mental health providers, their primary care providers, that they're not having regular interaction with the pharmacy. There's just medicine that may be getting mailed out every 90 days. So checking in to see how often are we taking this? Is it doing what it's supposed to? Should we change the dose? Are there side effects? Are there things we need to check for? That would be something helpful to link them back into knowing, so somebody's looking at it. Because if they're not walking into the pharmacy every month, there may not be that opportunity for the pharmacist to say, hey, this might be a problem, and we don't want that getting lost.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about weaning off of medication. A lot of people say this is absolutely a lifesaver. The medication is making all the difference. But some say, I'm not sure how much I needed it to begin with, but I'm really uncomfortable with my inability to get off of it now. Talk about that.
There are instances for patients with schizophrenia where there are patients who do very well without medicine. That doesn't tend to be a large number, and it's very difficult to be able to tell who's going to be successful without having medication. So when a patient presents and they have psychotic symptoms, hallucinations, paranoia, delusions, or false beliefs, they may require medication to help get those symptoms under control. But then it's going to be an ongoing relationship and dialogue to evaluate, is this doing what we were hoping it would do, and is this still necessary? So reducing the dose, sometimes there are no symptoms, not having bad side effects, we don't want to rock the boat, we don't want to make changes, that may not always be the best approach. So really being in tune with the patient's desire to be on medicine or not is going to be essential. If that's their goal, is to get off medication, then the healthcare providers and the system need to be supportive of that, because otherwise they're going to stop without anybody checking in and making sure it was done correctly. There are patients we could reduce the dose and see how much is needed, and that may also be enlightening for the patient to see, hey, at this dose, I don't have as bad side effects, so maybe I don't have the movement side effects where I was twitching or I was stiff, but I see that it still helps keep the voices at bay or my thoughts are clear. So it'll help them determine, oh, there is value here and this is about where we need to stay.
So it's not like you walk in the door the first day, you work out a medication, and that's that. Things change. People change. People's needs change. People's bodies change.
Absolutely. They'll change over time. So as patients get older, we really need to be looking at reducing the dose of some of these medications, because some of them may put them at risk for falls. So it might make them a little bit unsteady. It might make them a little bit more sleepy, even if they've been on it for a long time, because they can become more sensitive to the medicine. So it's an ongoing dialogue for all of the patients to see, is this still the best match for me right now? I think one of the big changes recently in early treatment has been to try to get patients on long-acting injections. So once they're on a medicine that works for them, there's been more, there are more individuals who are comfortable offering patients a long-acting injection, so a medicine that would actually last for 2 weeks or 4 weeks or a month or a few months, so they don't have to take the medicine every day. And that may actually lower the concentrations, the total concentrations of medicine that some of the patients are exposed to. Instead of having to take the medicine every day and the blood level goes up and then it comes down, and you take it again and it goes up and down, it's a much smoother curve that they would be exposed to, and it may make it a little bit easier for them to have their symptoms under control and manage some of the side effects long term.
The article I referred to in the New York Times looked at the very large growth in the prescribing of antidepressants and related drugs just since 2010. I think it was a 60% increase in people who were on it for 2 years or longer. I'll put that through the filter of a woman I talked with. She was 18 years old. Her GP prescribed Zoloft. It's 20 years later. She can't get off. Talk about that.
There are some individuals who become used to having the medicine on board. So when the medicine isn't present, they may notice some withdrawal effects. So if a medicine makes them sleepy, when they stop taking the medicine, they may feel more awake. A lot of times those can be temporary. For some patients with mental illness, once they're on a medicine, it's very difficult for them to come off of the medicine because those symptoms can come right back. Their depression symptoms, their anxiety symptoms, their other mood symptoms or their thought symptoms. So these are long-term diseases. They are lifetime diseases, and there is not a good way yet for us to be able to say you're going to have depression for a few weeks or a few years, and then we can look at taking you off the medicine. It is just constant monitoring. There are some patients who are on medicine, antidepressants, for example, that have been working and then they stop. And we're still trying to understand why. Why does that happen? And what's the next best step? So it makes it really difficult to utilize medicines as the first line if there is the threat that this may not continue to work for me, and then what will I be left with? So I think that's why it's essential we look at all different avenues of treatment, because the medicines don't cure patients with mental illness. They just help control the symptoms.
Like a diabetes medication would.
Exactly.
Okay. If I was reading, again, starting with this New York Times article, but then some others about microtapering, can you talk about that?
So in general, because patients will have been on these medicines for a long time, it's important that we lower the dose slowly, that we're going not quickly. There's no rush to get patients off of this, especially if we want them to be successful and be off the medicines long term. So looking at how quickly we need to decrease, it probably isn't a rush. Let's drop it, the dose just a little bit, and then monitor to see if there's a change. Then drop the dose a little bit and monitor to see if there's a change. For some patients, that may mean we drop the dose that you take every day. So instead of being on 10 milligrams, maybe you're on 7.5. In other cases, it may be only changing the dose once a week. So you're on 10 milligrams every day except for Sunday, and Sunday you take 7.5 milligrams. So it's really helping the patient be involved in the process and being sensitive to how their body is responding as we try to slowly lower the dose.
What is the best thing that's happening in your field right now, and what is the biggest challenge right now?
I think the best thing that's happening in the field right now is the attention that mental health is getting out in both the media as well as in the medical profession, because the attention that it's getting is not always negative. It's highlighting that this is an ongoing issue, that there are people who are struggling, and that there are amazing people who work in the field trying to make a difference. I think one of the bigger challenges is that we don't have treatments that are curative, and the treatments can be expensive. So cost constraints can be very, very complicated. If you have a patient who has a severe mental illness, but they're doing well with therapy a couple times a week and their medicine, and maybe they have a case manager that comes in and helps them with some activities, that may help them be successful enough to be employed. But if they are employed too much, that may boost their income, and now they've lost their coverage. And the new coverage may not cover those same services, but the only reason they could be successful was because all of those pieces are in place. So it's really difficult to be able to justify some of the services and costs of care for something that may happen in the future, because a lot of the insurance companies are looking at the now. How much does it cost right now? When we're trying to make their life better long term, we may not see the difference in the now, or that cost may look a little bigger, but it'll save money down the line.